The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be speaking to a sort of genius of metamaterials. He's going to be talking about these new engineered substances and how they're going to transform our world. But before that, I got a chance to chat with the brilliant Professor Marcus de Sautoy, who is a mathematician who's written a book all about shortcuts. And I don't know about you, Marcus, but when I was a kid, I used to spend my whole time trying to avoid work. I would do my room up like it was tidy, but always just shove stuff into cupboards and under the bed. I would try to get all the new cheat codes for the Nintendo games I used to play. Was this what your life was like as a child? Were you constantly trying to dodge the work that was put in front of you?
I recognize your introduction, absolutely. And I think that was why it was quite a shock when my math teacher at my comprehensive school revealed to us in a lesson when I was about 12 or 13 that this subject of mathematics, which at first sight, I think most people think surely is about a lot of hard work, you know, doing a lot of arithmetic, long division to a lot of decimal places. And actually he revealed to us through the kind of stories he told to us that no, this is actually what he called the art of the shortcut. It was all the clever ways that humanity has come up with over the last 5,000 years to avoid doing just mindless hard work and thinking about clever, better way to solve the problem and get to the solution in the kind of with the least amount of energy in the fastest amount of time.
Yeah, my maths teacher was very keen on doing these shortcuts. And I suppose the most disappointing shortcuts I made in my life was, as he taught me that we need to think smart. I looked at my work that I had to do for the Leaving Cert, which is the equivalent of the A-levels, I suppose, in the UK. And what I saw was I was reasonably good at maths, but I'd have to work a lot harder to do the higher level than I'd have to do all of the other ones. So my mathematics actually killed itself.
That's very interesting.
Ended up not working very hard and getting really good results because I figured out that I would have to work way harder at maths to do well in that particular subject. So my shortcut ended up, I suppose, hampering my mathematical career, which otherwise I'm sure would have not quite perhaps mirrored your own.
Well, I think you've picked up on something which is was part of my trajectory as well, because I went from learning all of these shortcuts that the mathematicians of the last centuries had come up with, and I suppose at school that's what we're being delivered, the shortcuts to the shortcuts. But then as a professional mathematician, I started to want to come up with my own new shortcuts, new innovative ways, new tunnels through the kind of into the unknown. And that actually was kind of a surprise, that actually coming up with a shortcut for the first time requires actually a lot of hard work, and sometimes you can't avoid spending a lot of time going in sort of, you know, up blind alleys, digging away, not getting anywhere. And in a weird way, coming up with a shortcut, if it was too easy, it wouldn't be satisfying. There's kind of sometimes I actually celebrate mathematics being hard in some sense, because the joy of it is then having that aha moment when you suddenly come up, oh, I found a little tunnel through to the other side, and that's incredibly rewarding. But I think, you know, once we've come up with a tunnel, you know, it takes a long time to build a tunnel under a mountain, but then everyone else can kind of whiz through. I think it took, there's a new tunnel that was built under the Alps, which is the longest tunnel now in history. It took 17 years to build, but I think it takes 17 minutes to go through it. So in a way, this new book I've written is, you know, it's taken us 5,000 years to come up with these incredible suite of shortcuts, mathematical shortcuts. But here, this book is your kind of shortcut to get through that to the other side of the Alps, mathematical Alps, or whatever problem you're faced with very speedily. So we've done all the hard work for you.
So you're obviously not talking about the sort of shortcuts where people write the answers to their problems on the inside of their sleeve with a pen. Give an example of sort of mathematical shortcuts, the legal shortcuts you're talking about. Tell me about Gauss.
Yeah, I mean, Gauss is one of my mathematical heroes. He's a kind of companion through this book because he is really the master of the shortcut. And it was a story that my teacher told me, told the class about the young Gauss sitting in a classroom. The teacher set the class a problem, which he thought would take them ages, so he could just sit back and have a little bit of a nap. He asked them to add the numbers up from 1 to 100. Now, the kind of long way to do that is start at 1, add 2, add 3, add 4, take your ages, probably make some mistakes on the way. And so the rest of the class started off like that. But even before the teacher had finished setting the task, Gauss had written a number down on his slate, put it on the desk, and the teacher was kind of like shocked, thought, this, who is this cheeky 9-year-old? And then he looked down at the number and there was the correct answer, 5050. And the teacher said, well, how did you do that so quickly? He said, well, I found a shortcut, because you don't want to start at the beginning and go to the end. You actually want to consider the kind of beginning and the end of the journey together. So what he did was to add 1 plus 100, which is 101. Then he added 2 plus 99, which is also 101. 3 plus 98, 101. He realized that if you take them in pairs, you've got 50 lots of 101. Well, that's 5,050. And the beauty of this shortcut is that it didn't matter how large a number the teacher said, 1 to 1,000,000, Gauss could apply the same trick and it would take the same amount of time to add up the numbers from 1 to 1,000,000 as a 1 to 100. And I think that was for me, the revelation. Wow, what an incredibly clever way to look at that problem. Don't consider the journey start at the beginning and go to the end. Pair the things up and you've got this incredibly quick way to solve what first sight looked like just a problem just full of hard work and slog.
I suppose in a way, the things that we learn in the early years of school, a lot of them are those sort of mathematical shortcuts, like trigonometry is in a way a shortcut, you know, finding out radiuses or how things relate, how shapes relate to each other. Now that we know that, it's easy to do, but to have figured that out in the first place, that was a serious shortcut.
Yeah, and this is what was amazing. I mean, I think actually we cheat our kids at school without telling them really what trigonometry was first used for, which was as a shortcut to navigate the night sky. Because what astronomers in kind of ancient time realized was that, if I look at distances and angles between stars and planets and the sun, I can actually use these triangles, which I can draw on a piece of paper, to tell me about the relative distances between these things out in space. So trigonometry was our first kind of telescope, our shortcut to understanding what's happening off our planet, which I think is, an extraordinary tool. So I think all of the things we teach our kids at school, they are our suite of shortcuts that we've come up with over the centuries.
Yeah, and I suppose without those shortcuts, we wouldn't have gotten very far, because we need all of these tools that are handed down. It's sort of building on the shoulders of giants and allowing us then to go quickly through the stuff that was impossible, to then to use tools to try and find new shortcuts. With modern mathematics, have they sort of become very few and far between, these? I'm thinking of the Millennium Problem. Is that people look at, that's the Millennium Prize? Are those mathematical challenges that you can win a huge cash prize for? Are they essentially a search for shortcuts?
Well, there are big open problems. So, for example, one of them is about prime numbers. There are infinitely many of these indivisible numbers. And yeah, I think the task is, for 2,000 years, we've been trying to find some sort of shortcut to understand how these prime numbers occur throughout the universe of numbers. Is there a pattern? Pattern searching is a great shortcut. I talk about that as one of my first shortcuts in the book, because spot a pattern and then you can predict how things are going to play out. But it's very interesting you mentioned the Millennium Problems, because I end the book with what I call the impossible shortcut. So sometimes there are problems that actually there may be no clever, fast way to solve them. And one of the Millennium Problems, which is called NP versus P, rather technical name, but it relates to a problem called the traveling salesman problem. And this is, if you've got a set of towns and roads between the towns with their distances, can I find a route around all of the towns in the shortest way possible? Now, there's a trial and error way. You can just try one route after another and list them all, and then you find the shortest one. That's the long way to do it. What we'd love is an algorithm which would just look at the map and say, well, there, that's the shortest way.
Every city in America, for example.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That's going to become very, very mathematically difficult.
Yes, but there are some problems of a similar nature where an algorithm will just tell you by looking at the layout a fast way to find that route. And of course, you know, this is a practical problem because a lot of haulage companies are having to take goods around. They want to minimize the amount of fuel use. They need to solve this problem. But we think this might be a problem that has no shortcut, has no clever algorithm. And the challenge is that mathematically, you've got to prove there's no shortcut. So that's interesting. You know, the art of the shortcut, mathematics, is now being used to try and understand when some problems do not have shortcuts.
What about GPS? Does GPS not do something similar? Does that use shortcuts to give us a shortcut?
Yeah. Well, yes, exactly. I mean, sometimes you need to know what's the minimum amount of information I need to know in order to be able to solve a problem. That's very kind of mathematical way of looking at a task. And so, for example, GPS, how many satellites do you need to have to be able to pinpoint your position perfectly in three-dimensional space? So again, that's a mathematics has analyzed that and said, okay, you can get away with this number of satellites, but if you take one away, you're actually going to have some unknown in exactly where you are. And again, we can sometimes actually calculate that unknown. So maybe you're prepared to give up a certain amount of precision for cutting down the amount of data you get. So I think one of the shortcuts I talk about in the book is kind of the shortcuts for looking at data. And I think that's very relevant to our kind of modern world. You know, we're inundated by massive amounts of digital data, and things like artificial intelligence are having to make decisions about, well, how many pictures of cats do I need to look at before I know that I can classify an unknown picture of a cat and a dog.
And representative polling as well. Like, if you look at all of America and you want to predict how an election's going to go, how many people do you have to ask a question of before you've got a very high rate of accuracy? Because we've seen it go both ways, right?
And what is surprising to me when I learned about this kind of shortcut about, how many people do I need to poll in order to have an accurate description? It's actually quite a few number. I mean, I talk about a story. I remember when I was a kid, there was an advert for cat food and it said 8 out of 10 cats prefer Whiskers. And I don't remember our cat ever being asked about its preference in cat food. I was like, well, how many cats did they ask to know to be able to make that claim? And there are 7 million cats in the UK. You only need to ask 250 cats their preference, and 19 out of 20 times that gives you within 5% the actual value that the general population their preferences are. So that's an incredibly small number. What a shortcut to being able to make a claim like 8 out of 10 cats prefer a particular sort of cat food.
Yeah, it's like that absolutely confounding birthday paradox, which every time I think about it, it really makes me question whether or not that's actually true, that you only need, 23 people in a room?
23 people.
23 people in a room to have an over 50% chance that two of them have the same birthday, which seems so crazily small when there's 365 days in a year. So that's the sort of shortcut that it seems mathematics are always looking for, mathematicians. And I suppose that is the beauty of these elegant equations that mathematicians are looking for, isn't it?
Yes, and I think actually, you know, I called the book Thinking Better because I wanted it as a sort of to lead on in a way from Kahneman's very famous book, Thinking Fast and Slow, because I think, you know, that birthday problem is a perfect example. Your intuition will say, surely you need, your fast thought, your intuition about that will be, oh, I need probably about 150 people, don't I? But actually, no, you need to analyze it in a kind of slow way, as Kahneman says, to be able to say, no, actually, you only need 23. But you don't want to take ages working that out. So what this book is a sort of like, here are the fast ways to think slowly, the shortcuts to actually not using your intuition and heuristics, which are generally bad ways to analyze a problem. These are the clever ways we've come up with, which are often counterintuitive and go against that first fast thought you might have.
It is always a danger, though, isn't it? Sometimes when we oversimplify something, if we try and mathematically, sometimes it can really click and be certain, but that's not always the way in real life. We take shortcuts and actually we lose a bit of the detail, and the representation isn't as accurate as we want it to be.
I really make a distinction between this being a shortcut and cutting corners, because I want this shortcut to genuinely get me to the correct solution. But you're absolutely right. Some of these shortcuts do involve throwing away information which isn't important. One of my the examples I love is topology. This is kind of bendy geometry. And if you think about something like the London Underground map, or a map of any underground system, you know, that is not a geometric map. You don't care about the distances between the stops. What you care is, how do I get from one stop to the other? And so the map of the London Underground, very famous, iconic map produced by Beck in the 30s, is not a physical replica of how these those stops are laid out. When you see actually where the stops are, and the fact that between Caledonian Road and King's Cross is actually a really long distance compared to, you know, Piccadilly Circus and Leicester Square. But actually, you don't care. You just want to know, I can get from one to the other with one train. So I think that's a great example of, yeah, I don't care about the distances. I care about how it's connected.
Yeah, except I've been caught out by Beck's map.
Oh, yes.
And when that's when I thought, oh, well, these two don't connect. I'll just get out here and I'll walk. And that's where your map breaks down, because you want a proper representation, not a simplified version of it. Really interesting speaking with you. In the book, Marcus goes into shortcuts that sort of exist outside of mathematics as well. And it's filled with lots of, as all of Marcus's books, lovely little anecdotes about mathematical problems and how they're solved. The book is called Thinking Better, The Art of the Shortcut. Professor Marcus de Sautoy, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on.
He's brilliant, isn't he, Marcus? It's always great to speak to a science communicator who really understands how to kind of get across these sometimes complex ideas in mathematics and science. Now, it's often the case that the technology we see being used on the big screen in science fiction is actually rooted in what's coming down the road in the real world. Be it bionic limbs, spaceflight, or the likes of tablets that we use on a daily basis, the future may not be so far-fetched. The same is true with the likes of new metamaterials and the incredible applications we might see in the not-so-distant future. Nathan Myhrvold is co-founder and CEO of Intellectual Ventures and the former Chief Technology Officer of Microsoft. He joins me now. Nathan, lovely to speak with you wherever you are. Where are you?
I'm in the Seattle area.
Okay, very good.
Where I live.
And we're going to talk today a little bit about metamaterials and the sort of future they may shape in terms of technology. Would you mind explaining what exactly metamaterials are?
Sure. So conventional materials are either made up of some element or some mixture of elements. And, you know, if we look around, we would find metal and plastic and
wood and
ceramics
glass
and all kinds of things in our daily life. Mm-hmm. It is an interesting material. Now, if we got onto an airplane, we might discover something a little different than that, where we would have stuff like a honeycomb panel. And a honeycomb panel has a center that was engineered in one particular way. And then it has stuff on the outside. That stuff on the outside might be aluminum, but it might also be some composite made of layers of carbon fiber. And it's by making that sandwich of materials, each one doing a very specific thing, that we get the properties that we want out of that material. Reinforced concrete is perhaps another simple example, where you have a concrete which is very strong in compression, not so strong in tension and pulling. So we use steel reinforcement bar, or rebar, which creates the tensile strength that we need, which when combined with the compression lets us build bridges and all sorts of things.
So a definition of a metamaterial in the strictest sense, Nathan, is is just a collection of materials used together to take advantage of the different properties of the materials inside?
Well, I'd say it's a little more than that. It's a bunch of specifically designed structures and circuits. And those specifically designed structures and circuits can act collectively as if you had a material with some almost magical property.
Well, so you say magical. What sort of things could these metamaterials do?
Well, one of the great problems in shipbuilding is that we use light as a way of creating the chips. So we project light down onto the surface of the chips, and that allows us to create little structures and patterns. And that idea of using light to project down was a fantastic one.
You're talking about lasers?
Generally not lasers, as it turns out. The way you make a microchip processor or a memory chip, pretty much the same, is you make a mask, and the mask defines the circuit that you want. There's usually multiple layers of these masks. But then the way the layer gets built is you put a material called photoresist over your chip, and you project light through this mask, but you make it much smaller than the mask. And by making it smaller than the mask, you can make the super tiny, super powerful computers that we've gotten used to. And that process also allowed us to make fantastically complicated chips dirt cheap. You can buy memory chips for just a couple dollars that have billions of parts on them. Billions of parts because they store billions of bits.
Right.
And the bits are stored each in its own little memory cell. And those memory cells are insanely tiny, but they're also insanely cheap to make. Otherwise, we couldn't afford to have streaming video or streaming music or lots of other things. So we've got this problem that you can only do that projection trick for light of certain wavelengths. Because when the light wavelength gets short enough, it becomes X-rays, basically, and we can't build lenses anymore. However, with a negative index of refraction, you can actually make tiny, tiny features with larger wavelengths of light. Or to take some examples that are in companies I've helped start, you can make what amounts to a lens for a radiation, which in microwave we would call an antenna, but you can make one that is electrically steered. So you don't have to physically move a dish in order to get it from a different point of view. You just electrically reprogram the antenna. So we've got a company that does that for satellite. We have another company that does that with radar antennas. You know, if you have, as the sky fills with tiny little drones, we want to be able to detect them. We want them not to run into each other. We want them to certainly not run into big planes and cause them to crash. Well, we need lots of super capable tiny radars. We also need those radars, by the way, for self-driving cars, because although a lot of cars have a vision system, obviously a vision system doesn't help you very much in the fog, as we know with our own vision system called eyes. So in all of these cases, this magic of metamaterials lets you do all of that. You know, some areas that we're excited about, but we haven't gotten fully into, are things like medical imaging or medical therapeutics. We use ultrasound to look into people. Ultrasound is generally safer for looking into people than X-rays are, but you can't use the ultrasound for doing very many therapeutic things. Except someone has figured out a way to use ultrasound to break kidney stones.
Yeah.
And that allows you to have a kidney stone therapy that doesn't involve a knife. You don't have to cut into someone. So it's cheaper, it's faster, there's much less recovery, there's many fewer side effects.
But ultrasound is sound waves, not light waves.
Well, it turns out that, yes, very good. The same mathematics, or pretty much the same mathematics, tells you could do this with sound waves. And there's a variety of different applications people are interested in for sound waves. Perhaps the most unusual is a proposal that I think is ambitious almost to the point of science fiction. But there's some French scientists that have said, hey, what if we could prevent or reduce certain ground motions during earthquakes? There's another set of very ambitious people who've said, hey, what if we could reduce the size of a tsunami coming in a bay?
How on earth would you do that? How would you do that with metamaterials?
In both cases, the idea is you build a metamaterial, which would be large concrete blocks or weights of some sort anchored in the ground in a very specific pattern. And because they're in a very specific pattern, they would cause a reflection or an absorption of the energy from, in the case of earthquakes, something called surface waves. And surface waves are often the most destructive part of earthquakes. And the tsunami people have a similar idea there.
The idea is to change the air, the direction of the energy, like making that refraction of minus one?
Well, not quite, but almost. So a tsunami, of course, is a big wave created by an earthquake. And a tsunami is funny because when it's out in the middle of the ocean, it's not very tall at all. It's 6 to 12 inches high. And it moves ultra fast. It moves about 500-600 miles an hour in the deep ocean.
Wow.
So the problem with a tsunami is when it comes up close to land, you get two effects. You get the fact that the continent or whatever is causing there to be land there, the landmass, is making the water shallower, and it's doing so in some coastal structure. You know, some coastlines are dead straight, but most aren't. Well, the size of the waves you get and the destructiveness of the tsunami depend a lot on what goes on in that undersea topography. And that's been known for a long time. Well, if you built the right kind of structures on the seafloor, which would be a very ambitious undertaking. It's not clear to me anyone's going to do this tomorrow. It's quite possible you could dramatically reduce what the tsunami effect would be to protect a city, for example. And the energy that you would have come from the tsunami crashing ashore would get re-radiated back out to the deep ocean. Now, that's super ambitious. Something that has been demonstrated in a lab is invisibility. So David Smith and John Pendry did a bunch of mathematical calculations. They said, you know, we could make a metamaterial cloak that would cause light waves or radar waves to go around an object. And as a result, that object would be nearly invisible to light waves. You did it at light wave frequencies. So people were very skeptical. So of course they built one. They built one in the microwave frequency, and they built something that basically disappears for certain microwave frequencies. Now, the military has stealth technology for aircraft. This is quite different than stealth. Stealth involves making an airplane with very specific geometry and with coatings that cause it to absorb what happens, any beam of light. So it's analogous to the black cat in a coal bin at midnight.
Yeah.
Whereas the metamaterials approach says if you put any illumination on it, it just gets bent around the object and it continues off the other side. So it'd be extremely hard to detect it. Now, of course, what we've built so far is not the Harry Potter style invisibility cloak. What has been built so far is only for microwaves and only at some frequencies. But I don't know, invisibility sounds like it'd be a pretty awesome technology.
It sounds like there are a lot of very exciting applications for metamaterials. Really brilliant speaking with you. Nathan Mervold, co-founder and CEO of Intellectual Ventures and the former chief technology officer of Microsoft. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
I get the sense that he is the sort of maven of metamaterials, Nathan, from reading up about him. And some of those ideas are really cool, aren't they? All right, it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week. And we're talking about super fast computers. We had Damian Thompson from the University of Limerick. And someone says, absolutely excellent piece there on future and current chip design. Hope it's available on podcast. It is indeed. Another says, really interesting to hear your last piece on innovation in computing. I wonder if it has implications in the world of blockchain. The low energy computing might mitigate the environmental impact of some blockchains. Well, very topical conversation that at the moment, seeing as the Minister for Energy and Climate, Eamon Ryan, has said, not sure if we're going to have blackouts at the end of the year. And a lot of people are pointing their fingers at these large data centers, which are, of course, computing using a huge amount of power. I think, you know, low energy computing is of course a need for the future. I think the applications of these are probably not the same applications for data centers and not the same applications for blockchain. But maybe in the future, maybe someone will come up with a blockchain light and find a way to make something like Bitcoin without it being so dreadful for the environment. It's a good question. And then Greg says, what was the name of the professor from Limerick, Damian Thompson? And how long before this new idea of iron molecules instead of gate switches comes to place? I think he was saying, you know, they're looking at sort of applications, but probably, Simon, what, 5-10 years?
Yeah, he said it was ready to go. But yeah, I think the time frame that we're going to be looking at is the next 2 to 5 years or thereabouts.
Yeah. Yeah, which is very, very soon to see a technology jump into actual production. I'm sure we'll get an email from Damien now saying that's very early. But like, this is something that is badly needed by the computing industry. We need to find a way to make things that are fast, small, and also don't use up that much energy. Well, that's it from our podcast this week. If you liked it, let people know about it. If you didn't like it, just keep it to yourself. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. Thanks to producers Aidan McKelvey and Simon Keane this week, Garrett Mulhall and Steve McLoon, who was on sound. Podcast, by the way, next week will be on a Sunday rather than a Saturday, as we move to a new slot on the radio show that has a fall-on to our podcast, which will be going out on a Sunday. Looking forward to just joining back with you then. In the meantime, stay curious.